This episode of The Smoking Simian is going to be brought to you by Life Boost Coffee. I cannot say enough about it, guys. It is some of the best coffee I've ever had. It's some of the healthiest coffee that there is on the market at all. It's 100% organic, single source, grown, and picked by farmers, by actual people, right? There's no, it is not a machine doing this. These are people who, and by the way, right, Life Boost is a phenomenal company because of this. They pay these farmers very sustainable wages. They believe in the Rainforest Trust. They're actually a part of the Rainforest Trust. They believe in sustainable farming. I apologize for mixing the terminologies there, but you know what I mean. If you look at the back of the package, there's a little stamp on the back that says a portion of all profits go toward protecting the environment. And right under that, you'll see ingredients, 100% organic coffee. And I'm not making this shit up, people. This is the healthiest coffee on the planet. It is low acid, very, very low acid. That's the best part about it. All of us that drink coffee throughout the day, you know, I only have one cup a day, but I would assume people who have, you know, two, three, four cups a day have a real bad acid reflux problem. And maybe you shouldn't be having that much coffee, but if you already do it, then fuck it. That's what you do. Might as well do it a little healthier, right? Get some of this Life Boost coffee in you. No acid, no lower quality beans to cut the good stuff. You know what I'm saying? This is all 100% top quality shade grown coffee beans. It's grown in a fucking on a mountain, over a mile high. You know what I'm saying? Over a mile high, and at that elevation, it really prevents, you know, these terrible fungi to from materializing. And these fungi are the source of metabolites that lead to health detriment. And they're found in lesser quality coffees that maybe aren't shade grown, maybe aren't grown this high at this type of elevation, and aren't shown the care and the rigorous, you know, the rigorous process to produce this coffee. You know, you won't find any of that subpar junk in Life Boost coffee. It's phenomenal. I'm telling you guys, it's phenomenal. God damn it! I've had people on here. They drink it. They love it. Take their word for it if you don't fucking believe me. But what I'm going to do for you guys is you have to click the link in the description of the show. Wherever you're listening to it, there is a link there, and you will take it, and then you will travel on a dirt road for about 10 miles until you reach a frog, and the frog actually speaks Chinese, so make sure you have your translator out on your phone. Make sure your phone's charged, and you understand what he's saying, because he'll direct you to the cave of the wizard, and the wizard will direct you up to the mountain, which is about a 30-mile hike, where you will then get 50% off your first order from Life Boost Coffee. Just make sure that when you click the link in the description and you go through all this, that when you get to the site, you click Get Discount, so you can get your discount. You get a choice of dark roast, medium roast, light roast, ground, or whole coffee beans. I think you can even pick decaf. And then there's two different packages on there. You can get either three of these or like six of them or something. And it's a great price. It's half off. It's a phenomenal company. And when you support them, you support the show. So go ahead, check that out. And that's that for Life Boost Coffee. Next, we have Obsessive Aggression, my brand. Make sure you guys check that out if you guys are in the market for some top quality premium boxing gloves. 16 ounces. They're great for anything. They're great for hitting the bag. They're great for sparring. Hitting pads, whatever you want. And it doesn't matter what skill level you're at. If you just go to a cardio kickboxing class a few times a week, or you're training to punch a hole in somebody's face, these are great gloves for all that. Like I said, they're the best quality that I tested. They're the best quality that I saw. Some things you know, you can just tell with your eyes. Those are shitty gloves. I'm not even going to waste the time, you know, getting them in. And this is the beginning of something great, guys. If you guys want to support a local business, a small business, this is how to do it. Especially if it fits your niche. If you train and you need some boxing gloves, or if you're brand new, you know what I'm saying? These are great. So make sure you check out. There's a link there too. Wherever you're listening, there's a link. www.obsessiveaggression.com. Check out the site at least. You know, you don't even need to buy anything. At least if you check out the site. And tell your friends about it, because we have some cool pictures. We have a cool video on there. Link right to the YouTube. There's also a link to the show on there. So it's all on there, people. So check it out there. Get on that and get obsessed. Now, the reason why I did all that at the beginning of this episode is because this is one of the more serious episodes I've had. And when I say serious, I don't mean not lighthearted, because it is just a lighthearted conversation between two old friends. Two old friends, right? This guy's double my age. A lot of the subject matter was very important, and I didn't really want to stop him in the middle of it to say, oh, hey, get some coffee and check out my gloves. Like, no. I just wanted it to be the conversation. I mentioned it at the end, you know, like I always do, but I hope you guys enjoy this episode. It was great catching up with this gentleman, and that's it. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Smoking Simeon podcast yet again. Today I have somebody I haven't spoken to in a very long time. 15 years, I think we did, we figured out it ended up being about 15 years since we last spoke. And I was just a young boy. Mr. Glenn Goldsboro. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, Antonio. How about yourself?
I'm good.
Good, good, good.
Very happy that, how many kids you think from 15 years ago have hit you up to sit down and have a conversation again?
You'd be the first.
Yeah.
I've run into a few, but not in this format.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I'm super excited that you agreed to come on. I always say that I kind of throw out these invitations on a whim, and I'm almost always surprised that some people are always so willing to just come on. Mm-hmm. So the way that we know each other, and like I said, very long time ago, I was a little kid, 8, 9 years old. You're my football coach. First year I've ever played football.
That's correct. Yeah.
It was my only year, actually. I played a little bit in high school, but it was a lot of fun. It was definitely a lot of fun. What got you into that?
I started coaching when my son got involved. My son got involved at an early age, about 6 years old, I believe he was. He started with the flag division.
Okay.
And in order to make him feel more comfortable, and because I was there at the practices anyway, I offered to help. And the head coach at the time, Steve Andreozzi, took me on as a quote-unquote assistant. So that's how I became involved. Once I signed my son up, I pretty much signed the whole family up.
Right. And that was on the, you said the flag team. That's when he was on the flag team.
Yes, that's when he played on the flag team, yes.
Okay. And when did you kind of make the transition to coaching kids who had pads on? Because I feel like that's probably a little different.
Right. Well, that's very different. Well, like I said, I became involved with my son. So when he advanced to the junior peewee division, then I tagged along also. I inquired of the head coach at the time as to whether or not he needed any help. Again, as a father who stayed for the practice and watched and observed, I thought since I was there, I'd lend a hand. And he graciously accepted my invitation, and so I became an assistant coach at the junior peewee level.
Right. So by the time I was there, you'd been there for a while.
I had been there for a number of years, correct, yeah.
Okay. And at that point, how often, or was that, that wasn't your first time as a head coach?
No, that was my first time as a head coach.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Steve Andreozzi eventually took over the junior peewee. He was promoted to the junior peewee head coaching position. He had his eye on the peewee division.
Gotcha.
And as soon as that became available, then Steve moved on to the peewee division as the head coach, which enabled me to get promoted. My first and only promotion to the head coach for junior peewee.
Right.
So I coached at the flag level as an assistant for about a year and a half. And then I was an assistant coach at the junior peewee level for, I believe, 2 years. And then Steve Andreozzi was promoted, as was I. And I became the head coach for the junior peewee division.
Right. Right. Yeah. One thing that really stuck out, Now, like I had mentioned, I was only on your team for 1 year. I was a little kid. One thing that really stuck out about the team was how you were able to encourage everybody there and make everybody feel like they were a part of the team. A big thing that I'm realizing as I get older and get involved in different things, that environment is everything. Where did you get this sense of like calm, cool, collected encouragement that you kind of brought to these kids, that some of them you don't know what's going on at home? That sense of encouragement might be the only encouragement that they get. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you kind of always had, or was that, okay, now I'm a coach, I kind of have to add these kind of things?
Well, that's a great insight. I'd have to say, obviously, being a father of young children, that certainly helped a lot. Young children are impressionable, and I kept that in mind.
Right.
But I kind of developed my own skills as I went along, trying to keep in mind the age and the learning capacity of the youth that I was involved in instructing. So to answer your question, I'd have to say that I kind of learned as I went along.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's great, because like I said, I was only there for a year, but it left such a huge impression on me. Mm-hmm. When I messaged you about all this, I brought up the story of me getting injured. Our first scrimmage, yeah. It was, you know, everybody was excited. I was excited. First time my family had ever been to a football game. and they got there right as I was kind of getting, you know, carted off the field. I got injured. I got hit in the chest or something like that. And what always stuck out to my parents was that you checked up on me afterwards. Called you? I'm pretty sure you possibly showed up to the house.
I'm not sure. I don't remember.
Maybe. But that, even that level of commitment is admirable, because you know some people can just say, "Oh, I'm a football coach," but they're other people's kids.
Yeah.
Like I don't have to worry that much about them, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know, that's really meant a lot. And I know I wasn't the only one that you did that for, but just to even think that you would go to that length was great.
You know, when you bring that up, I think of the word inclusive. Mm. And I always wanted every member of the team, whether it be the coaches who helped me. I hate to call them assistant coaches.
Right.
Because we were all coaches. But whether it be any of the coaches who helped me, the team mother, who had an instrumental role herself, or any of the children involved in the program, I always wanted to make sure that they realized that they were included, that they felt like they were included and that they meant something. I felt the need to check in on my players periodically, especially when I found out that maybe one may have been struggling in school or something. Or if maybe one came from a single family home and didn't have a male in the house, I check in on those players to make sure that they were doing what they needed to do in school, first of all, and that they were getting the guidance that I thought that they may have been lacking at home. Some of it showed on the field, mm-hmm. By the way they conducted themselves.
Oh, 100%.
And I quietly have a conversation with their parents to see if they're to offer my help or my assistance, and then I dealt with the players on the field in the best way that I knew how, in a stern but encouraging manner.
Right. Yeah. And it's funny, because before right before you were coming over, I was kind of looking back and really bringing myself back to when I was on the team. Mm-hmm. And you say you were stern, but you were also very, in contrast, you were also very caring about the whole situation. Mm-hmm. So again, it brought a different dynamic, and it was one of those it was one of those teams that you leave, even though we were kids, we took more than just how to play football away from that.
I tried to give you that. Sure, absolutely. You brought up a good point at the beginning of the interview here. You mentioned something about making a transition from flag to tackle.
Yes.
And that's exactly the level that I was instructing at. So every player that came to me, it was their first year playing tackle. And because it was considered an instructional program, especially the level that I coached, I only had the players for 1 year. I didn't have the advantage of having a player for 2 years, like the other levels. Even Flag had their players for 2 years, and that was an instructional level.
Right.
But I was a key instructional level because it was players making their transition from, like I said, Flag to tackle. Players came to me not knowing how to get into a three-point stance, mm-hmm. not knowing how to wear their gear. So I had to teach them all of those basics. So we had to learn from the ground up. And I was always very, very proud of the job that the coaches and I did at that level, especially when you consider that you had to do it every single year. You didn't have a person, not one single player coming back that had the advantage of you know, being under your tutelage of the year prior. Right. You started from the ground up every single year. So it was a lot of work, a lot of dedication, but it also, we had a lot of success.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I remember, I'm pretty sure we won every game but our last.
We did.
Yeah. And it was against the Steelers. I don't know what town that is exactly.
Yeah, that was West Warwick.
West Warwick, yeah. Right. And we had, I remember there being a girl on their team. That was like the big thing at the time. And we lost, but I remember at the end of that, it was like, you know, don't hang your heads. Yeah. We did this as a team. And that's the interesting thing about a team sport, right? Where, you know, you yourself aren't going to make the whole difference. Yeah. It's impossible. It's rare, we should say that, at least in a team sport. Especially one where the team is as big as football.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if you're Tom Brady or something, then you can take the whole game in your hands. Yeah. But, you know, to be able, and then to have a bunch of rambunctious kids and then coach them in a way where they can all work cohesively to try to, at the end of the game, you know, impose their will throughout the game and at the end of it be satisfied or okay with the outcome.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to tell you something you probably don't know. About that game. That game was actually the last game that I coached.
Okay.
I had gotten a promotion at work, which required me to work nights again. And being the head coach, I had other coaches there that were assisting me, that were ready to step up and run the practices for me. Not that I'm a control freak or anything like that, but I just felt as though if I was the head coach, I needed to be there.
Right.
And I couldn't lay that burden on them and then just show up on game day and take over head coaching responsibilities.
Right.
So I hung up my whistle after that game. So that was a very emotional game for me.
Right.
I remember that game vividly. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that was big for a lot of us. And that's interesting. I didn't know that was your last one. And that was ever, you never coach a team ever again?
No.
Or?
No.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, it's crazy. I remember being, you know, I had never experienced, in my whole life I've done martial arts. And martial arts it's very much a team sport, but even more so you're one-on-one.
Right.
You take the whole thing in control. And that was my first time being a part of a team. Mm-hmm. And it was, it was very interesting. And later on, you know, you draw parallels. I was on the wrestling team in high school. And again, it's martial art combat sport, but it's a team. There's a whole group of us. Mm-hmm. And it was just great to experience that. And I'm super happy I was a part of it.
Oh, you know what? I'm glad that all these many years later, it left as good an impression on you that you still remember it and that you're still talking about it.
Yeah. So. another big reason why I wanted to get you on, aside from, you know, catching up and reminiscing a little bit, was your experience as a detective in the Providence Police Department. Mm-hmm. When did you decide that you wanted to kind of be in law enforcement? Was it something you always thought of, or was it like, I finished my time in high school, and it was more like a calculated thing?
No, I knew at a very early age that I wanted to be a police officer. It was either that or a truck driver. As a young child, I remember thinking how cool, I love the semis, you know, I remember how cool it would be to drive cross country all the time. So I joke about that. But yeah, I knew at a very early age, I'd say probably prior to high school, I had a very, very strong interest in law enforcement and felt as though that's the route I wanted to go.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's great that you were, you know, a lot of the things that we think of as kids, it's like we want to be, you know, the greatest at this or this person or that. Mm-hmm. And it's great that sometimes you figure out, okay, I want to be a police officer, and it sticks.
Yeah.
And it ends up being the right thing.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something else. After I joined the police department, I would pick my son up from preschool, and there was another child there who was pretty attracted to my uniform. So I'd go straight from work to pick him up, and he was pretty attracted to my uniform, so I used to interact with him. And one day his mother approached me and asked me, she introduced herself, and asked me if I'd be willing to go to his birthday party. And I believe it was his 4-year or 5-year birthday party.
Mm.
He wanted to be a police officer. He became a police officer.
Wow.
We're still in touch today.
Wow.
I think I just saw him last month, a month before. He's a member of the Warwick Police Department now.
Wow.
So at the age of 4, he was expressing interest in law enforcement, and he did it.
Early on. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. How long were you a part of the, how long were you a police officer for?
24 years.
Wow. 24 years. So what's that process like getting, because actually in a few weeks I'm having somebody who just is transitioning into becoming a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like? What's the training? What's the mindset? What's all that goes into, you know, the academy, the, you know, growing with a team, all this type of stuff? What's kind of going through your mind in your early steps of becoming a police officer?
Well, the first thing you have to deal with is the selection process. And if you were to ask me what the selection process is like, I can tell you it's very frustrating. It can be, anyway.
Right.
There are a number of hurdles that need to be negotiated before you're selected as a police officer. But I don't want to call it easy, but the less frustrating part,
right,
is actually the academy, because you're there.
Okay.
They teach you everything you need to know, at least they did back in the day, and things that have the way law enforcement has improved, I imagine that it's so much easier to go into a classroom setting and absorb what you need to absorb. But the point I'm trying to make is that once you're in the actual academy and you apply yourself, I mean, it's you're there. That's all you need to do is finish the academy, and you know you're gonna go on to a very, very rewarding career if you're fortunate. You know, I was on the police department at a time where cell phones and cell phone cameras and social media, that came towards the end of my career. So I think those things that I just mentioned, they happen to make it a little bit more difficult to be a police officer these days,
right,
or to serve in the as a public servant in any capacity, because you're under so much scrutiny. And I'm not saying that that they shouldn't be,
mm-hmm,
because you know they should be held to a high standard, and they do need oversight. But I'm just saying it just makes the job tougher, because the person behind that camera, just like you're going to edit this interview, the person behind that camera can edit whatever it is that they recorded before right. they show it to the public
right.
to make the police officer look bad. So,
not to mention that it's only one view of what's actually going on.
Exactly.
And it's an outside view of what's yeah. going on. It's not the, you know, the actual situation. Yeah. You know, there's that whole, I guess, conversation that's being had mm-hmm. now. There's police in the limelight mm-hmm. all the time. That now more than ever, some of the reasons are because of social media and cell phones
Absolutely.
And cameras.
Yeah.
And it's weird because at the beginning of last year, a whole bunch of bad stuff happened. You know, George Floyd, all these other things came to light. And then at the end of the year, now everybody's on the police side because there's people running into the Capitol. And it's like, why weren't things, you know, whatever. And it's just interesting. Did you have to deal with any of that, you know, any of that stuff going on maybe in a different way? I know you said the social media and the cameras and stuff kind of came toward the end of your career. But was there anything even comparable to kind of what's happening now?
Yeah, it was. I guess the most comparable thing would have been the development of community activists. Mm. I mean, community activists have always been there, but at a certain point in my career, community activists were given a seat at the table, so to speak, and the mayor welcomed them, and they had every right to be there, and you know, I think there was a need for them. Let me just say that also, there was a need for them to be there,
mm-hmm.
Because the you know as a police officer, you never want to think that the department's hiding anything from the public, so why shouldn't they have a seat at the table? But the community activists in the city had taken on a greater role and had developed some more influence. Let me just say that.
Right.
So it was actually boots on the ground, not necessarily a person behind a camera,
right.
but it was actually people actually out in the community that were making noise when they felt as though the police department needed to be held responsible for something.
Right. Now, is there a call for police officers now to be almost activists in their own regard and kind of calling out other police officers if, hey, this is... Or is it more like, we're all in this together, we have to stick together because we're, you know, this is... We're police officers, this is what we do.
How did you ask the first part of that question?
It was more like, you know, is there a call for more correction within the police community?
I certainly believe there should be.
Okay.
I certainly believe there should be. Coincidentally, during my career, I served for 3 years in the Internal Affairs Bureau. So it was my responsibility, in case you're not familiar with internal affairs,
mm-hmm.
to investigate complaints and allegations against police officers. And so for 3 years, I did that. That's just a small time and a small period of my career, but it had a lasting effect on me as a police officer and how I went about conducting my business. Having said that, in direct answer to your question, there's a strong need for officers to call other officers out. They need to do that. And I'd like to see more of it, absolutely.
Right. Yeah, because I feel like that's something that has to come from within. It's about mm-hmm. building that team. It's about mm-hmm. building the environment, the rhetoric, essentially, to breed officers that are, like you said, held to a higher standard. They police each other, almost. They're mm-hmm. almost, in a sense, policing each other's actions. And do you think that starts with, you know, different hierarchies within within the system, or do you think that starts with just, you know, building from somewhere else?
No, I think that that should be prevalent throughout the entire law enforcement community.
Right.
It should be second nature. If I see you do something wrong, I shouldn't hesitate to say, "Hey, dude, hey, he's got his handcuffs on, man. What are you doing?"
Right.
Because not only that, you're putting me in jeopardy too, because I'm there, and either I'm going to be called as a witness, or I could potentially face charges if it comes down to that, because I didn't do anything. So it should be something that is prevalent throughout law enforcement, from entry level all the way up to administrative.
Right. Yeah. No, I totally agree. Have you or anyone that you've known been in a situation where it was tense and, you know, there was possibly the need for force in a scarier way than most would assume? Have you yourself ever been put in a position like that?
Yes.
Is that anything you're willing to speak about?
Well, I mean, there are a number of different times where I was forced to use physical force to take a person into custody.
Right.
I mean, my arrest, for the most part, I guess I should be thankful and feel blessed that I never had any of my arrests questioned. But I grew up in the west end of Providence.
Mm-hmm.
So a predominantly minority neighborhood, where, and by the way, I grew up with strict parents.
Right.
who taught me how to respect individuals. They taught me how to respect it. And the most important thing, they told me that I would need to earn others' respects, the respect of others. And that's the mindset that I went out there with. And I always thought to myself, I need to treat others with a certain degree of respect until they give me a reason not to.
Hmm.
I need to treat others that I interact with, especially who've called me for help, like it's a member of my own family that's calling me for help. And treating people like that, and with going out there with that mindset, I think is one of the best things that anyone could do. At least it worked for me, where I used the amount of force necessary, and that was it. Once the person was in custody, that was it. It was over with.
Right.
Some people just, you know, they feel a need to administer a little extra punishment, you know, when it's not necessary. I can't say that happened in front of me on a regular occasion. I can't say that. Matter of fact, as I sit here, I can't even think of an incident where that happened.
Right.
And I know that I would have spoken up. It's a lot of it has to do with a lot. I be careful how I say this.
Take your time.
I think that if a city like Providence, where I worked,
mm-hmm.
would concentrate on hiring from a more diverse police force,
mm-hmm.
if they put emphasis on something other than military experience, I think some of the problems could be alleviated. Let me just put it that way.
Right. Yeah, I feel like you bringing up that you were brought up by strict parents who taught you essentially, you know, right from wrong, respect, these type of things. That's kind of a gap.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like there has to be some kind of correction along the way where it's like, hey, you know, maybe your parents weren't as strict, but we have to, like, get the message across that we have to, we're all human beings. We have to respect each other at some point.
And then there's another aspect also, some from right here in the state. And then actually just before I retired, I had noticed that there was an influx of others from outside of the state. But you'll have a lot of the recruits that are selected to join the police department. They've never spent any time in Providence or in the surrounding communities. They would come from, let's say, East Greenwich or North Kingston or way outside in the suburbs.
Right, right.
And
they don't get the essence.
Yeah, they've never had any dealing with any member of any members of the public who lives and works in Providence. And so that the first time they interact with those people or when they come here with a shiny new badge on their shirt, and they just really don't have any real idea how to deal with them.
That's actually an interesting perspective. So you're saying that it would be more beneficial for this city or town, whatever their police force is, to kind of take from their own whatever as much as they can.
Yes, as much as they can.
Right. Because I would assume it's probably tough, not to get the whole force, but. Right. But it is true. It's the backgrounds that people come from. Some people are more, more comfortable dealing with certain situations. You know, you have a guy that's, being a drunk and acting a fool out somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't warrant, injuring them seriously, shooting them or something. It doesn't warrant that. There's ways to handle situations. And it seems like you said, some people just aren't apt to do it.
Yeah. You talk about being a drunk and acting a fool. I had a boss that made a comment to me once, not that I was being a drunk or acting a fool, but he made a comment to me once when he found out that I was going to be leaving the night shift and going to the day shift. He said, "You're going to love it." He said, "It's a whole different environment during the day shift." Mm. And I'm looking, I'm like, "Dude, it's the same city. What are you talking about?" He goes, "The same a-hole, same drunk a-hole that wants to call you names and chuck you the finger at 11 o'clock at night will want to buy you a cup of coffee at 7 o'clock in the morning."
Right.
You know, that's the way he kind of like tried to convey the difference between the people that you deal with from, at night and during the day.
All right.
It was definitely a change, I have to say, but no one ever offered to buy me a cup of coffee.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the freaks come out at night, I guess. That's where... So you'd say essentially the more action is on the night shift.
It tends to be busier on the night shift, but right. It can get active during the day also. I mean, it's you never know when the feces is going to hit the oscillating device.
Right. So how long were you again, I don't know the hierarchy and how the ranks work as a police officer, but how long were you an officer before you ended up becoming a detective and getting these different types of promotions?
Okay. I joined the police department in 1987, and I was assigned to the investigative division for the first time, and I believe, what was it? My son had just been born, so probably around 1991, I was assigned to the investigative unit as an arson investigator, which was pretty interesting. I actually attended the National Fire Academy down in Emmitsburg, Maryland. It was a two-week program that I went down there and got a crash course in arson investigation. So it's pretty neat. But I had only been on the police department for a few years, and I still had a lot of, get up and go in me, if you will.
Right.
And they partnered me with a firefighter. We were a team, one firefighter, one police officer. We made up the arson investigation team. And the firefighters that were assigned to the arson investigation arson squad, they had one foot out the door. So
it's you complete know, opposite pre, of your
it's, feeling. Yeah, it's pre-retirement right. for them. And I go to work, and I'm like, okay, where are we going today? What are we going to do, you know? And, kid, relax. Yeah, with their feet up on the desk, reading Take the paper, it easy, you know. you just need to figure out what you're going to have for lunch, you know, that type of thing. Like, oh, come on, you know. So I stayed there for a very short time because I just wanted some action. Right. And I actually requested to go back to uniform and work the streets again. So for a short time, in late 1991, I was assigned to investigative division. And then once again in 1999, I believe it was, I was assigned in the investigative division again, this time as a domestic violence investigator. And I spent 5.5 years there. And it was probably a year and a half too long.
Okay.
Because I got burnt out.
Right.
In a position like that where you're constantly dealing with those issues, the phenomenon of domestic violence. Sometimes it's frustrating because you don't think that the perpetrator is being punished like you think he needs to be punished.
Right.
Sometimes it's frustrating because the victim doesn't cooperate after you put hours and hours into putting a case together. And a lot of times it's after the victim had been violently assaulted. And then come time to go to court to get the conviction, you know, you had no cooperation from the victim. So sometimes that would be frustrating, especially when within 2 weeks, sometimes sooner, that same victim will be right back at your desk making another complaint about the person that they wouldn't testify against in court. And so you had to have a certain degree of compassion, which I think I had, but you can't have any cynicism, which I had begun to develop. So at that point I said, you know, it's I need a change. So it was good work. I enjoyed it. I had a number of convictions. Matter of fact, one of the biggest investigations I had was when I was in the domestic violence unit. It afforded me an opportunity to be nominated for, and I received the Officer of the Month award. Wow. For that arrest that was made with that investigation. So it was rewarding, literally. like I said, you can only stay in something like that for so long. I forgot to mention the Internal Affairs investigation. The time I spent in the Internal Affairs Division, that's also part of the investigative division.
And when you were there, that's when you were dealing with the complaints regarding other police officers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And with that information, what kind of came about that? Was it just, it was stuff that was going to trial?
A couple of them were criminal.
Okay.
A couple of the investigations that I was involved in were criminal, but most of them were violations of departmental rules and regulations, and they went to a departmental hearing where a lieutenant or above would sit as the hearing officer and find the officer involved either guilty or not guilty, and he would receive the summary punishment of maybe a 1 or 2 day suspension or something like that.
Right.
But there were criminal investigations that I was involved in. Also, there was actually an officer who I want to say he shot himself. He staged a shooting.
Okay.
He shot a hole through his uniform. He got on the radio, the police radio, and called it in that he was pursuing someone who had just shot at him. And obviously, you know, everyone in the department that was working at the time, they ran to the area and searched the area for hours. The quote unquote suspect was never found. We took as much evidence as we could, and what we deducted was that he had shot himself. We took his uniform. We studied that. We took his vest. We studied all of that. And he actually went to, he was charged criminally. And he went to court and was found guilty and was forced to resign.
Mm. Did, was it ever deduced why he did that?
If you were to look up the hero complex, that's something that he suffered from. He was looking for accolades. He was looking for a lucrative assignment in the police department, because believe it or not, that's what would happen. Hey, kid, you got shot.
That's promote you.
You know, right. Where do you want to go now? You know, right. I want to go to the drug unit. Okay, you're going to the drug unit starting next week. You know
right,
what I mean?
Right.
Just, you know, look up the hero complex when we're done here. And it's not just in police departments, it's in fire departments, it's in the armed forces.
Almost a call for attention.
It's a real phenomenon.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I could imagine a lot of that stuff being incredibly taxing. Mm-hmm. Especially the domestic violence stuff.
Yes.
Not only is the schedule crazy and it's always changing and you're almost on call in a sense, but the subject matter is probably tough to deal with, I would assume.
It was. Yeah. It certainly can be. It certainly can be, yeah.
Right. And one thing that's always, one other thing before we kind of wrap this up here. How do you feel about the idea of, there's again, with the police being in the limelight and this type of thing, and there's you know, famous people who are talking about this and influencers and all this stuff, how do you feel about the idea of police reform and criminal reform in the sense of breaking up the jobs that police officers kind of have to focus on? Is that something that doesn't resonate with you, or something that makes some kind of sense, or anything like that?
No, absolutely. It absolutely makes sense. There has to be a better way to respond to a person in a mental health crisis than to sending a police officer who has no training in assisting anyone who's having a mental health crisis, number one, or doesn't have the right temperament or compassion in dealing with someone like that. And you and I and everyone else have seen the outcome, you know, when
that
a person
happens
like that does respond to those types of calls.
Right.
So absolutely. Not only that, but I definitely believe that the police should be demilitarized also.
Interesting. And now for me, somebody who kind of picks and chooses the type of information that they take in, what is this idea of demilitarizing it? What does that actually mean? Just to clear it up.
Well, the armored vehicles, in the way police departments across the nation respond to the public, say this past summer when the public was out
protesting.
Thank you. You would see some departments that had armored vehicles, and that's part of it. It's not just the optics of it, but it's an unnecessary expense for the police departments. That money could be used elsewhere. If not on the police department, somewhere in the community, it could be better spent. But that's what I'm really referring to. Some of the military equipment that police departments buy and purchase and really don't need, only use periodically, but yet there's a certain amount of money that's spent to purchase it in the first place, and then there's a certain amount of money that's spent on maintaining the equipment. You're talking about when people talk about defund, they're not talking about getting rid of a police department. Mm-hmm. They're talking about things like that. Defund them in the manner where you don't give them funds to buy military equipment. Defund them in the manner where you stop giving them monies to maintain that military equipment. That money could be better spent on after school programs for the same inner city youth that they're going to police. Mm. That's just my take on it.
Right. Well, I think it's a very progressive take. I think it's an interesting take. And you're not alone. You know, there's plenty of people who think like you, and I would agree with a lot of that stuff. And you know, we can only hope that, you know, only better things for the future.
Yeah.
And this was absolutely phenomenal to have you on. It was great to hear your commentary on being a police officer, mm-hmm. and the police force as a whole. And I really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great catching up.
Yes, definitely. Thank you guys so much for listening. Make sure you follow the show, subscribe to it on my YouTube, follow it wherever you listen in the audio platforms. Make sure you follow me on Instagram, Twitter. All the links are in the description of the show. You guys know the deal. Make sure you check out Life Boost Coffee. Get 50% off your first order using my link in the description as well. Click get discount, get your discount. And that is it, everybody. Thank you all so much. I'll talk to you Monday. Peace.
Wow, that went by faster than what I thought.
Yeah?
Yeah, you were right about that, huh?
Once you start rocking and rolling, it's not.